Thank you.
Thank you for sharing.
Anybody else? All right, we have a celebration tonight. Tim L. is going to be celebrating 90 days, supposedly. Yeah.
My name's Jim, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey Jim.
And I don't care what Tim thinks, this is all about me. This gives me a lot of pleasure. Tim has 90 days sober. I've been sponsoring Tim for 7 years. And I think God worked this out because we didn't have a 90-day pin for him. But we found a pin that was sitting on this thing. It has 5 on it. And I'll let Tim explain that to you. But Tim has been an active member of this home group. It's been 8 years. Holy shit.
Yeah.
So I've been sponsoring Tim for a little more than eight years when we started this group. And without further ado, I'll present you with this, whatever this thing is.
This thing.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Hi, my name is Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
And, a little over 90 days, I guess it's like 100 days now, 100 days ago. I came in here and told my home group and most of the people I've known less than 5 years that I'd gone back out 5 years ago and had been using for the past 5 years. And started a whole new thing. I was thinking there's no way that I can really face these people. I dreaded coming in here and telling people. I really did. And I didn't know what to do about it. I mean, I really thought, like, I'm going to come in, admit to it, and then just leave and, like, go to a different group, do something else. Because I can't bear it, you know? And I was definitely, like, going to get a new sponsor. Because I just figured, at that point, I've basically, like, lied so much. There's no way that I can ever, like, it never will work again. Over the past 90 days, I mean, I've, like, been through a lot, and I've been, you know, trying to, you know, start being honest and actually work a program, and, I had a couple of, like, really good talks with people in the group. Like, I think everybody in this group, I've been in this group for a long time, I've known everybody in this group a long time, but I bet I'd never called over half of the people in the group. And I definitely, like, I knew people were, like, text messaging each other all the time, but, like, I wasn't involved. And over the past 90 days, I mean, things have been hard. I mean, it's been really hard because, I was a pot smoker. I mean, that's what this whole thing is about. Like, 5 years ago, I started smoking pot again. And I always thought it was no big deal because I wasn't drinking. You know, for me, like, drinking was the problem, and so it really didn't matter that I'd been smoking pot. And when I quit, then, like, definitely, like, within 2 weeks, I just started getting slammed with depression and anger just on a regular basis. You know, I'd just wake up in the morning and just be like, you know? And I mean, that desperation, just, like, feeling that way and not even having a good reason for it and just being like, you know, what am I supposed to do? Got me to start calling people, texting people, going to a lot more meetings, and getting active again. So, anyway, that's where I'm at tonight. I'm actually fairly happy at 90 days, and I thank God for this home group because I don't know. I really, I did not expect to to find the level of support that I did here. But actually, I don't know. I feel like I have more friends in the group than I did, you know, 100 days ago. And I guess it's because I'm flawed. And everybody in this group seems really flawed. Now I fit in. Anyway, thanks, you guys.
And I'd like to introduce our main speaker, Carl.
All right.
Thank you. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. First, I want to say, Tim, I'm shocked and appalled. Not surprised. I'm just shocked and appalled. He looks so normal, you know? I mean, every time I come here, this dude's here. He's carrying kids around and stuff. Well, I guess you'd smoke pot, too, with carrying kids. But nothing surprises me anymore. Nothing surprises, especially not in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is August 16th, 1985, and it's been unnecessary for me to smoke any pot, to take any mood-altering drugs, any sips. You know, it all counts, you know. I mean, I've had problems, but you know, I've been so close to that line. I've been so close to that line so many times, and it's been unnecessary. It's been unnecessary. I 23 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my second meeting today. I attend a meeting every day. I don't stay for the whole meeting, but I do attend a meeting every day. And on the weekends, I usually get to several over the weekends. And it's not because, gee, I love this so much, although I do love it. It's because I need this so much, you know, because I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I find myself restless, irritable, and discontent often. You know, and when it comes up, I don't call it, you know, anything else but alcoholism. And I've spoken here enough. I'm going to kind of skip through my story real quick. I just want to say that the first time Clancy came to speak at the first anniversary was the first time I knew that there was a sponsorship group. Jim called me up and asked me if I could get some coffee pots, and I can always put my hand on some big coffee pots. And I remember that night vividly. One of my sponsees was picking up the coffee pots, and his car breaks down in the parking lot of Chatham High School, Chatham Borough, and Jim had to come down and switcheroo of the coffee pots and then go into the big auditorium. It really didn't fill up. We didn't fill it up for Clancy, but Clancy spoke that night, and Jim asked me to come speak at the group shortly after, and I was so impressed. I walked into the, and they were downstairs in the basement, and they had a board up there, and there were guys actually working with guys on their inventories. You know, going down the 8-step list as I came in, and they're erasing it and stuff. And I'll tell you something, this group inspired me. And I think that's what it's all about. No matter how much time you have, time is just a delusion. You know, all we have is today. All we have is today. And if you're not doing more today, you can't stay sober on what you did 5 years ago. You can't stay sober on what you did 2 weeks ago. Dude, 3 days, that's awesome. Ooh, you've got some bad stuff going on in your life, huh? Yeah. Yeah. I'll I'll tell you something, man. Nobody gets here because they're on a roll. You know? Most of us get here on the balls of our butts, and I'm one of them, you know. Real quick, I always start with the story, 13 years old. You know, I had been nipping for a while, but I'd never caught that buzz, right? And I had been smoking for a while. You know, I had smoked my first cigarette when I was 7 years old, and I blew up my house. With, you know, there was gasoline in a room, lit a cigarette with a buddy, and we both ended up in Overlook Hospital for 4 weeks. And, yeah, appreciate you guys laughing about this. It was one of the high points of my life. And, you know, my first introduction to morphine and things like that. I mean, I was messed up. I was 4 weeks in one day. I'm in Overlook Hospital. The day I get out of the hospital, I find a pack of cigarettes in my father's dresser, and I'm in the bathroom having a cigarette the day I get out of the hospital. And I'm 13. I'm 13 years old. But the guy who I blew up the house with, we got very close over the 4 weeks and one day in the hospital. You know, we were side by side, operations, the whole bit. And we were best friends before that. But after that, I mean, there was really a bond there, you know, because nobody else was allowed to hang out with us, so we hung out with each other. And there was one night, but everybody knew us in town, and we got some guy to buy us beer, and we were going to a party. And I had experience with parties that you'd hook up, and I knew one thing about myself. When I get to a party, at least the first one I remember, I was not enough. I walked in, I was with a group of people, I knew most of the people, not very well, but I knew I was not enough. And when I walked in, I remembered, hey, how you doing? Fine, how are you? And I didn't know what to say anymore, I didn't know what to do with my hands, and I figured my fly was open, and, you know, did I wear the right clothes, and, you know, do I stink? What, you know, whatever. I'm not enough. I don't measure up with these people. And I just remember being at this thing like 12 years old and just feeling the hot flush come off my face and just wanting to crawl into a hole and die. And I don't know why. I don't know where that came from. But it came. Now, here I am, 14 years old, and we're going to one of these parties. And the parties, I've been to parties since then, never had great experiences. But tonight, guy shows up, hands us a couple six packs of beer. We run into the woods. We sat out in the woods, banged down the beers, went to the party, walked into the party, and this amazing transformation took place of all the people in the party. They were so glad to see me. They were so impressed. And they were just, hanging on every word I said. Just, it was this one, and I walked down the stairs, and this guy looked up and said, oh my God, Bull's bombed. And I looked at him with a big smile on my face. Yeah, you're right, Bull's bombed. You know, I was as cool as everybody looks. And I made up my mind that night I was going to do that as often as possible. And as often as possible, I did. And one night we were at another party, and I remember we were all drinking downstairs, and the cool people were upstairs smoking pot. And I'm thinking, well, I wonder what's going on up there. I looked up there, and it was three couples, and they were running around. The women were in their bras and panties, and the boys were in their tighty-whities. And I said, how do I get into that party? That's the party I want to be in. And it was also right around that time that my father was an executive working in Manhattan. And my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was through my dad. By way of two members of Alcoholics Anonymous bringing my father home one Saturday morning. And it was during a time that there was a lot of dysfunction in our house, which means there was a lot of fear and loathing of each other. And, you know, what's going to happen? My father's going to lose his job. He's going to kill us. He's going to do, you know, because he was out of control. He was just out of control. He had been gone for several weeks. And these two guys from AA brought him home, sat us down, talk to the family about alcoholism, recommended Alateen, which just sounded too corny for me to participate in. I was way too cool for that. But I also had this major resentment against my father for, you know, all the stuff that he had put us through. I must have been 17 at that point. And over the next 13 years, from 1971 until my father died on January 24th, 1984, he was sober. He was sober. He had been in AA for about a year before he achieved sobriety. He did go out a couple of times. But finally, he came around and he stayed sober. And I had heard about AA and I went to his anniversary meetings. Every time I came in contact with AA, somebody would pull me aside and say, you know, we think it's a hereditary disease. You know, why they're picking on me, I don't know. But they kept pulling me aside saying, you know, we really think this is hereditary. And I was bound and determined I was not going to be like that SOB, my father. So I was going to, I used a lot of other substances. I never got very far away from alcohol, though. I was, you know, there were people I knew that, oh, when we're doing this, we don't do this. And I'm like, you know, give me a break. Come on. When I do everything, I'm doing this. You know, if I and I have to say, you know, I really had no drug of choice. I had no choice. If you had the drugs, I was doing it. If there was no drugs, I'd drink. I liked having drugs and drinking because if I didn't have the drugs to temper the drinking, my drinking really got out of control to the point of blackouts, etc. It seemed like marijuana would knock me out. I'd get to a certain point and I'd just pass out someplace, which was better than blacking out and not knowing what I was doing. But I'll tell you, I ended up working for my dad in Manhattan. And I very quickly found out that they dealt drugs across the street from our office in the Bryant Park. There used to be a den of dealers in there. And my father, the first day I worked for him, we were cutting through the park on the way home, and we got to the other side of the park. He said, I've been walking through this park for 23 years. Nobody's ever offered me a nickel bag or a joint. And 15 people offered us on the way walking through the park. And I said, that's not because they know me. It's my first day. They will get to know me very shortly. I'm going to go right to my last drink because there's nothing real sexy about my drinking story. You know, there really isn't. There's nothing. It's pathetic. It's really pathetic. You know, I once again, you know, I was always, I'm never enough. I'm never enough. I'm going to stay until 7 o'clock in the office and I'm going to work extra hard because I want to get ahead. And the first night I'd stay until 7 and I'd get a lot of work done. The next day I'd say, you know what, I'm going to go across the street. I'm going to get a couple of tall boys, bring them back here. And, you know, I'd have to walk past Bryant Park on the way across the street to get the tall boys. And then, and after a while, I'm just hanging out, drinking and smoking pot in the office. And, you know, what's the point? You know? You know, a couple of incidents. You know, I got knocked on my butt and buying drugs over in Times Square, going through a hole in a fence with a couple of gentlemen that I had just met who... They didn't even show me anything. I showed them the money before they showed me anything, and they bopped me and knocked me on my ass. It's really never ended up in jail, never ended up in the hospital, just ended up in pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, time and time and time again. And I'd always pick myself up, brush, just like when I blew up the house, you know, the day I get out of the hospital. The day, you know, if whether it be I suffer through a day without taking a drink until 5 o'clock, and then on the train ride home I'd have a couple, and I'd feel marvelous all over again, you know. And once I kicked it off, I never knew where it was going to take me. And I drank like a pig. I did drugs like a pig. I did everything like a pig. And I was always trying to control it. I was always trying, why don't you drink like Jimmy? Why don't you drink like Johnny? Why don't you, you know? And I could never do it. I knocked myself out trying to do it, you know? And my last drink was on August 15th, 1985, and I was on a business appointment with a guy that was to become my partner, and they went very well, and he was being very nice to me that day. He was my boss at the time, and he goes, why don't we go, we'll stop at this watering hole, find out where the bus stop is. And I said, sure, you know, we stopped there, we banged down three or four. He said, nobody knew where the bus stop was, so I drove him to Shanghai Reds. Shanghai Reds is right on the Hudson River. It's now the Chart House. And Shanghai Red with beautiful bars, multi-level bars all over the place. And with these big overstuffed chairs, and you could sit back and you could look at the Manhattan skyline. And I was sitting there and they were talking to me about becoming a partner in the business. I don't know why, but they're talking to me about becoming a partner in the business. My father had passed away at this point. And we're banging them down, and I loved that talk, that, you know, and I feel like such a big shot, and I'm looking at that skyline going, I'm going to own that city, you know. And then I finally drove him into the city, and that night we closed the bar, and this was a wimpy 1 o'clock in the morning bar, you know. And I left the city. I was driving a Ford LTD because 2 weeks before I had smashed up my company car. And I'm driving this Ford LTD, and I'm going to go through this really quick because everybody remembers this stuff. That, you know, I don't remember exactly, like, I was in this blackout because I didn't have drugs that night. It was pure alcohol, and I'm like going in and out of a blackout. And I just remember coming down to the toll booth outside of Newark Airport there, coming off the turnpike. And I'm going 50 miles an hour. I have $150 in my pocket. I have no intention of paying the toll. One of those things. I just don't feel like talking to anybody, you know, like, here's your change, sir, you know, because... And so I ran. There was no Easy Pass back then, baby. This was Easy Pass, you know. I ran over the cone, and I'm shooting down the road, and I'm looking in the rearview mirror, and there's nobody chasing me. There's nobody. Everybody's like, yeah, I'll let them go, you know. And I'm driving, like I said, a 1985 Ford LTD was a boat and a big V8 engine, and for whatever. And I was always, like, very scared driver when I was hungover. You know, very cautious. Oh, my God, I lost numerous friends. Seriously, I had numerous friends die in fiery car crashes when I was a teenager. All alcohol and drugs, very close to me. And so I was kind of chicken when it came to that stuff, you know. But not this night. You know, a Ford LTD with this V8, I'm going 85 miles an hour down what is now Route 78. At the time, it was called Route 24 Express because Route 78 wasn't done. And I remember coming out of a blackout as I'm driving, and the car is swerving all over the road, and I can't regain control of the car. I don't remember it starting. I just remember being in the middle of it, and there was no way of controlling this car. And I went smashing. They had these PVC barriers set up right where Route 78 merges into Route 24, and I went smashing through these barriers, and I went up on the grass, and I regained control of the car, and I sat there, I went, no problem, bang, I was back out on the road. And I got home to my mom's house. She had a beautiful house, Chatham, up right across the street from the entrance of the cemetery, and went down Chandler, and I went to turn into, I know this because this is where the car ended up, not because I remember doing it. Came down, and there were these two big rocks that were painted white on either side of the driveway, which is supposed to indicate the driveways in between these two rocks. And I missed the driveway by about 2 feet, and I plowed the car up on top of one of these rocks and pushed the rock and the car up into the middle of the front lawn. And then played the game, I'm going to rock the car off the rock, right? Throw it into reverse, throw it into drive, throw it into reverse, and there's mud kicking up all over the place. And then I just threw it in the park. I said, screw it. And I went in the house and went to bed. And the next day, my brother calls me up. And I pick up the telephone, and he goes, Carl, I do not know how you're going to get the car off the rock. Your front wheels are completely off the ground, which is the way I left this car, is wedged up on this rock. And I'm like, oh, no. And so immediately I went to the refrigerator and I got a can of beer. And that was my last drink. I took the can of beer. I went to the window. I popped it and I looked out the window. And I'm watching the neighborhood parade. The cars, they're all rushing to the train station until they get to our property, and then they slow down. And they go driving past this monument to my stupidity on the front lawn. And they're just, you know, and I'm just like, oh, God, you know, what do you say? And for whatever reason, on this day, I was at my end. I was at my end. And there's more to this story. I got to backtrack in a little bit. But on that day, I finished that can of beer. A friend of mine came. We got the car off the rock. And he said, this happens to everybody. Right? You got to have a friend like that to do the stuff we do. Right, Davis? Right? We got a friend that says this stuff happens to everybody. For what, I just remember taking my pack of cigarettes and I threw it across the room. And I said, what has to happen to me before I stop this stuff? What has to happen? Do I have to find a tricycle underneath my car instead of a rock? Do I have to find, like, some little old lady stuck in my bumper before I'm going to stop this stuff? What has to happen before I smarten up? And my buddy left. He didn't want to hear that conversation. And my father had passed away a year and a half before that. And I had his phone book, and I started dialing for donuts, man. Started dialing, and I talked to Harvey Baldwin, who was the treasurer of the Summit AA group. And he had been a good friend of my father's. He was there that morning. It was a Friday morning. And he said, have you had anything to drink? And I said, well, yes, I have. I had a can of beer. And he said, do you think you can get through the rest of the day without use it? And I said, yeah, I think I can. And he said, well, good, then I'll come over, I'll pick you up at 7 o'clock tonight. And he took me to an AA meeting over at Overlook Hospital that night. And just to backtrack, it took me, I was in AA a year before I remembered this. There's a Long Hill Chapel over here on Shunpike that my mom and dad had been very active members, and my mother had invited me to a dinner at the chapel. And I was a big chapel. I hated this idea. Like, go to your chapel to hang out with your friends. I, you know, not a good idea. I'm a drug addict. I'm an alcoholic. I'm having an affair with a married woman in the next town. I am just, you know, I am not the type of guy that you want at your chapel dinner. But I am your son. You're asking me. Okay, I'm going to go. Now, this was sometime between January 24th, 1984, which, by the way, Bill Wilson died on January 24th, 1971, the year my father came into AA. My father died on January 24th, 1984. That's why I remember this stuff, you know. And at that dinner that night, I mean, there's a lot of praising the Lords, and there's a lot of people that look really nice, people my age that are doing very, very well, much better than me. And I certainly do not measure up to this crowd in any stretch of the imagination. You know, plus, I haven't had enough to drink. Plus, I've had no drugs. This is a bad situation, you know. And I'm sitting there, and it's getting a little surreal. And there's this lawyer standing up here talking about his relationship with Jesus Christ. And I'm like, dude, I got to go have a smoke. And I go outside, and they're praising the Lord out there while they're smoking. I'm like, how do you get away from this? And I come back. I'm sitting at the table, and they pass a clipboard around. They said, if anybody's asked Jesus Christ to be the Lord and Savior, just write your name down on this. And I'm like thinking, you know, he got the wrong guy here, you know, and the thing came in front of me, and I can't explain it to this day, but I wrote my name down on that piece of paper. Nobody was looking. Nobody saw me do it. I did it very stealthily. And I passed it on. And when I left that night, I'm like, you idiot. How could you be so stupid? They know who your mother is. They know where she lives. They know you're living there. They're going to want contributions. They're going to want you to coach the basketball team. They're going to want you to come set up the tent and shake the tambourine, you know? They're going to want something from you. You're an idiot. You're an idiot. But I was driving past that church a year into my recovery. And, you know, I was not drinking and going to meetings, and I was restless, irritable, and discontent, and I did not measure up in here, out there, any place. In the office, no place. And I'm driving past that church one night, coming home from a speaking commitment up in Morristown, and I'm thinking back, and all of a sudden it dawns on me that I wrote my name down, and I had asked Jesus Christ, and he didn't know I wasn't serious. You know, that I took an action expecting nothing, thinking it was stupid. That action was stupid. We're going to be asking you to do a few stupid things that aren't going to make any sense, that are going to change your life. And that action, all of a sudden, I saw God working in my life, because my life had changed 180 degrees. And that's what this is not a self-help program. This is a God-help program. And I spend an awful lot of time today seeking God. I am an alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life. And probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism, and God could and would if he were sought. You know, what's our choice to be? You know, I love that. I love, you know, when I became alcoholic, crushed by a self-imposed crisis I could no longer postpone or evade, I had to fearlessly face the proposition. Either God is everything or he's nothing. He either is or he isn't. What's our choice to be? I mean, that's like my mantra, you know? What's your choice to be? It's either everything or it's nothing. And I don't do it perfectly. I don't do it perfectly. I love this group, you know, with all your commitments up here. I have a monthly commitment at the Morris County Jail that I absolutely love. And I just want to tell you a couple of things that have happened to me through this service, you know. Like I said, never ended up in the hospital, never ended up in jail until I came to AA. And then all of a sudden I started going on jail commitments and things. And the first time, you know, and I volunteered up in Morristown, and bing, bang, boom, I get the commitment. And the next thing I know, they're throwing me in a room full of guys. And it's like, you know, what am I going to say to them? And, you know, I don't have to, this is what I say to them. Let's read more about alcoholism. You know, four examples of alcoholic insanity. You know, let's read Bill's story. Let's read There Is a Solution, which is wonderful, which is absolutely wonderful. But trying to make sense of that stuff is really tough. I needed a tutor. And I'm too proud to ask for help. I'm way too proud. It took me years. It's pathetic how long it took me to really get into this book. But it took me years to find myself in that book. I finally found myself in that book on page 109. I'm husband number two. You know, if you don't know what it says, take a look at it, because that's me. You know, you really want to know. That's what I was. I just, I always thinking I could do it. I'm not that bad. I'm not that bad. I'm not that bad. How bad do you have to get? From the jail, there's one night, it was a Saturday night, and this guy comes in, and his name was Mike. And he had never been in my meeting before. And I happened to tell him that when I was a newcomer, one of the things that I was told is to ask God to show himself to you. And it just, for whatever reason, I started to do that when I was a newcomer. And all these weird coincidences used to happen to me, especially after I would ask God to show himself to me. And I would be sitting there having I don't know whether you guys have conversations in your head like this, but the one side of my head would say, there's a frickin' coincidence, huh? That this happened. And then this other side of my head would go, you asked. You asked God to show himself to you. Yeah, but it's not a burning bush, it's not, you know, levitation, it's not, you know, water into wine. which is a good thing for a drunk like me, you know. But, you know, it's not, yeah, but you ask what, you know, and these coincidences would keep coming up. And so I was sharing this at the meeting. The following Thursday, I have a commitment at Mount Kimball Hospital, driving up there with my buddy Glenn. And as we're driving, I see Mike out on the street. And I go, oh, my God, that's that guy. That's the guy. He was in the meeting. He's in the meeting. No, it's not the guy. It's Mike. It's Mike. And Glenn's like, what should I do? Because I'm freaking out in the car. I'm like, what's this guy doing? He's like, should I pull over? He pulls over on the green. I'm out stopping traffic in Morristown to get this guy. I come up to him, and he looks at me. He goes, I knew I was going to see you. And I said, you knew you were going to see me. I said, I'm never in Morristown, except for last Saturday and right now. He goes, but I knew I was going to see you. And he went to the meeting with us. And on the way to the meeting, he's telling me how he got out of Morris County, Roseland Police Department, picked him up, took him over to Roseland. He sat in a cell for 24 hours. No TV, no company, nothing. Sat in a cell. And during that time in the cell, he's thinking about the meeting on Saturday night. And he asked God to show himself to him. He said, I don't know if there's anybody up there. The guy said, I'm asking, what's, you know. He goes in front of the judge. The judge looks at him and says, Mike, you're a pretty smart guy. Why don't you clean your life up? Why don't you get your life together? And then he read down a list of charges as long as your arm, and he said, time served, 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 time served. He said, do you have a place to stay? He goes, yes, sir, I'm staying at the Market Street Mission. He goes, do you have a way to get back? He goes, no, I have no way to get back. I'm in the mission. They don't have cars at the... And the guy looked over here at the detective. He said, detective, you're court ordered to drive him back to the mission. And the detective said, excuse me, I mean, I get off very... And he said, I'm a frickin' judge. What don't you understand? You're court ordered to drive him back to the mission. And the detective drove him back to the mission. He runs into me. He goes to the meeting. He shares to these guys in this outpatient IOP. Shares to them. And then I tried to follow up. And I think, to the best of my knowledge, the dude blew off AA after that. And his whole purpose was to give me a spiritual experience. And the last time I spoke here, I not only got the booby prize, Brian. Jim gave me Brian as a door prize. Said, here, take him. Good luck. And I not only got Brian, but this guy Matt comes up to me. He says, would you mind speaking at the Market Street Mission? I said, of course I'll speak there. And when I went there, I'm sitting there and I'm going, oh, my God. You know, it was one of those nights, you know, tough day at work. It's a hot night. It's hot. And I'm up there and I'm like, what am I going to tell? And I see all these guys coming in and they all got their white piece of paper. They're pulling out to get signatures and stuff. And I'm thinking, you know, I've never been to jail, never been to the hospital. And certainly never had first trip to the mission here. And what am I going to tell these guys? And I'm telling my story. And part of my story is, towards a year in AA, I was going on vacation. I told this the last time I was here. I was going on vacation, and I had my tent set up in the backyard, and I'm sweeping out my tent. And I'm sitting there thinking, the guy that I loaned this tent to, man, he smokes a lot of weed, and I bet you there's some stuff. And, just curiosity. I wonder if there's any seeds or anything, and I'm sweeping it out. And it's nothing. There's nothing in there, and I'm shocked. There's nothing in this tent. But then I look outside the door of the tent, and there's a joint laying right outside the door of the tent. And I'm like, bang. The one hand's on my lighter, my hand's shooting out the door, grabbing that joint and coming back in. My only thought is I'm going to fire that mother up. And the thing crumbled in my fingers. It was a mushroom stem. I kicked the cap off the mushroom stem, and I swear there was a little twisted end on it, and it looked just like a joint, and it crumbled in my fingers. And I'm sitting there going, dude, you got a year. You've been washing coffee pots. You're not drinking, going to meetings. You're the secretary of a group. You're this. You're blah, 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 blah. How are, what's the point? What chance do you have of ever staying sober? What chance? How are you going to make another year? How are you going to do another 90 days after this? How is it possible for you to be ready to light that doob after everything you've done? How is that possible? And one night, and this kicked around me probably 3-4 weeks. And one night, I'm driving my buddy Pete home, and I dropped him off at the Canoebrook Country Club. And Pete always, I'd pick him up, he'd climb the fence. He had lost his license for like a year and a half. And he had like 12 weeks when I had 8 weeks. He was just a little bit ahead of me. We got our 90-day pin on the same time. And he looked at me and he said, Carl, you got 45 minutes left. It was 11:15. I wanted to know how I was going to stay sober for the next 5 years, and he said, you got 45 minutes left. You just have to make it to midnight tonight without picking up a drink or a drug. And that was the message I got. And he got out of the car, he climbed over the fence, and he went back to his quarters. He was a greenskeeper at Canoebrook. And I drove away from that little conversation with the weight of the world off my shoulders. Now remember, I'm at Market Street Mission telling this story. And I'm out of steam. There's 10 minutes left. And I said, you know, I got nothing else to say. I got nothing else to give you. Does anybody have anything they want to kick out? Does anybody have anything they want to share? Does anybody have anything? And this hand goes up in the back. And I'm looking at the guy, and he goes, I'm trying to place your face. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, I'm trying to place your face. He goes, I'm Peter from Canoebrook. And Peter from Canoebrook was sitting in the back of the Market Street Mission. And Peter from Canoebrook, to the best of my knowledge, had 9 years sober before he picked up. And Peter from Canoebrook smoked pot for that 9 years that he was attending Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And Peter from Canoebrook had ended up in the Key West homeless shelter after many, many, many trials and tribulations of the alcoholic, because after 9 years he picked up, and picked up in a bad way, and he moved down to Key West, and he held jobs for a while, and then he lost his apartment, and he ended up, and Peter from Canoebrook was very quick to tell me, it's not that bad. It's really not that bad, the Key West homeless shelter, because they wake you up in the morning so you can go to work, and when you come home, they show you a movie, you know? And you don't have to pay nothing, and they got public showers, and so you're not dirty, you're not disgusting. But Peter had wiped out on his bicycle. He had all of his worldly possessions slung on this bicycle. And one of the things slung on the bicycle was his bicycle helmet. And he had taken a header and banged his head. And because he was a homeless guy, he really didn't get the medical attention that human beings are entitled to when they smack their heads. And he ended up having a stroke. And his short-term, that's why he really didn't know me. He did know me, though, because when we started talking after the meeting, he mentioned some things that only he would know about me. Cause, you know, like he asked me if I was still canoeing, which was no, I haven't canoed like in 20 years, but he remembered that from my early recovery. I was very into whitewater canoeing and things like that. And I go see Peter every Thursday up at the Market Street Mission, and we do their chapel. Mike's done it there, and singing songs to Jesus with a bunch of homeless people is I don't know, it lifts me up. It really does. It takes me to a different level. And that's what I'm looking for, because I wasn't made for here. I need something more. I need something more. This isn't an act as if. This is seek, and that's what I do. I go seek, and you know, they asked me to open the meeting about a month ago, and I got up there, and the whole, these guys are really into praising God and things, and I've, you know, I'm not used to this vocalizing my praise, and it was good for me. It was really good for me. I need to be challenged with this stuff. I really want to thank you guys for everything that you've done, for the example that you guys set with your for your service, your diligence of working these steps and promoting the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which in 1985 was not being promoted. At least it wasn't being promoted to me. And when I got into that book, it changed my life. My sponsor is Father Jack over at Overlook Hospital. He's been my sponsor since I got up enough nerve to do a real fifth step, you know, withholding nothing. I sat down with Jack and did a 2.5 hour fifth step. Pathetically, you know, I probably had easily 14, 15 years in Alcoholics Anonymous before I really did a fifth step. And I want to tell you, you know, my life changed. My life changed. And when I made amends. I made some unbelievable amends that just absolutely cracked me open. Absolutely cracked me open. There was one woman that I had almost married, actually. And when I came to AA, I used to talk about her a lot, and I used to talk about her family a lot. And it all got back to her that I was talking about her and her family in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one day she just lit into me. And you know, the first time I got very indignant, and I told her, I said, back off. I said, were you there? I said, do you know what I said? I said, well, if you weren't there, why don't you just, you know. And I backed her right down, right? But she wasn't done. She came back a little while later, right? And when, as soon as she started it, man, the rage just came up in me. Just came up, and I was ready to. If she had been there, I probably would have killed her, you know. And then I big amends it, but I was on the phone, and when she brought it up again, I said, "Listen," and I mean, I was practically in tears because the rage was. I was so torn, and I said, "I want you to know something." I said, "If I did anything to hurt you, I want you to know it was not my intention to hurt you with those words. And if there's anything I can do to get straight with you, you say the word and I will do it." And I just left it at that. And it all the venom left her. And she hasn't brought it up since. And that's the way, that's when you see that kind of power, I don't know where that came from, because it certainly didn't come from me. You know, this stuff works. And it works so well for bozos like us, because we're all bozos on this bus. And I can't say enough about you guys and about Alcoholics Anonymous. And John, thank you for calling me and asking me to come. And I'm 10 minutes away. And I have a big book study tomorrow night in my basement, 42 Sherwood Drive. Everybody's invited. There's going to be a few of these guys here. And that's all I got. And I think we have a nice way of closing. Yes. Absolutely. Fantastic. Thank you.